Hello, I'm Ed Butler, and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. Today, a Nobel Prize winner says we must fight to tackle the injustices of globalization.
We need a new social contract. We have to have shared prosperity. If we do that, then there will be the kind of support for globalization and openness that you see in, say, the Nordic countries.
Also in the program, the Indian street traders and their daily battle with police to stay in business.
They're always asking for bribes, taking all our money. We're poor people. We're just trying to make a living. Where do you want us to go?
All that in Business Daily from the BBC. Many of us today will be launching ourselves back on the first day at work after a New Year break. How does that feel for you? Armed with new resolutions, perhaps new hopes for the year ahead. But what will 2018 hold for you in economic terms? 2017 was a bumper year for global stock markets, we're told. The FTSE and especially the Dow Jones hitting record highs. Hong Kong rose by more than a third last year. But is that the basis for wider optimism? Are there hidden icebergs threatening the good ship global economy for us all? To read the tea leaves, I'm now joined by two market watchers and global economic experts, Gabriel Stern from Oxford Economics and the independent political risk analyst, Stephanie Hare. Let's look at the markets, first of all, if we may. A boom year in London, New York and Hong Kong, Gabriel. Why?
Well, I think obviously central banks have had a role in this. I think a very stable macroeconomy has probably been, in the last year, the bigger aspect. And in fact, although people are used to talking about markets being, asset valuations being stretched, actually what we've seen recently is much less talked about, but it's a period of almost unprecedented macro stability in the global economy. I mean, the last time things were this stable in the global economy, people such as Mervyn King, old governor of the Bank of England, gave it a name, the Great Stability. That was in the 1990s and 2000s. This time, I think it feels a bit less great, but more grating, in that, yes, you've got stability, but it's worrying. You've got weak growth, actually. You've got inequality. And again, as you said at the start, Ed, asset valuations very stretched.
Yeah, I mean, Stephanie, potentially becalmed. And then all of this on the back also of huge quantitative easing that we've seen for stocks globally, and a sense that the real prices of things, like in the US, the stocks are hugely overvalued. I mean, you know, in terms of the actual earnings for these companies to the prices that the stocks are given.
Yep, and we're also looking at things like the rise of cryptocurrencies. We're looking at the tech companies that so far have been able to avoid regulation, really, which would be something that, if that were to change, might really change their fortunes. So I think you're right to point out the fact that we're in a really frothy state in the markets that doesn't necessarily correspond, perhaps, to actual value.
Yeah, 8 years, though, of a bull run. Gabriel, I mean, are you a bull or a bear now in terms of what the next year, at least?
I think I'd be somewhere in the middle for next year, in that, I mean, I think I can't see what the trigger is for a really big setback in markets. And in fact, if you look at the big risks in the world economy we're facing now, maybe North Korea, US-China trade war, I mean, they're not really that major compared to what we've been through in the last 10 years. You know, if you think of a China credit crunch, Eurozone breakup, tantrums in global financial markets, global deflation, worries about Donald Trump, capital flows to emerging markets. I mean, these were huge risks. And I think what we're facing at the moment, always worrying as an economist, but not quite what we've seen in the last 10 years.
Stephanie, I mean, are you as bullish, firstly, and also that risk question, how do you price in the fears of, for example, conflict in Korea, or I don't know, a populist president in the US doing something totally unpredicted. I mean, how do you predict the unpredictable?
Well, I think you want to look at the sort of the known knowns. You know, so I think Gabriel's absolutely right to have pointed those out. I think I'm intrigued by things that could really change things. So, for instance, if the Democrats take the House of Representatives in the US midterms and launch impeachment proceedings, and we suddenly have a United States that is in full political chaos.
That would be 2019, though, wouldn't it? I mean, effectively.
It would be in terms of when they would finally get started, but they would probably signal that pretty much straight away. So you could see that. I could see if the Brexit talks derail, there could be a really interesting confluence of risk here in Europe, right? So it's never just one thing. So imagine a Europe this year in which Germany's Angela Merkel isn't able to form a coalition government, and Italy in its elections in March puts in the five-star party or just has to have another snap election because they can't get it going or decides that they're going to change the constitution and allow for a vote on a referendum whether or not to leave the euro. Things that seem really long right now, not particularly close on the risk horizon, but which could still surprise us.
But would a bad Brexit be bad just, I mean, it would obviously be bad for Britain, but would it be actually bad for Europe? Do you think it could be significantly bad for Europe?
It will dent Europe. So right now they're starting their EU budget negotiations, for instance. So they would have to then demand greater contributions or make greater cuts to the sort of products and services that they're hoping to offer in regulation within the EU. So that could put a strain on some already straining. This is very delicately and finely balanced political risk.
OK, let's go to the real economy for real people then. I mean, we've talked about markets and we've talked about these big questions. Is there a decoupling going on between these kind of markets, these signs of growth? I mean, positivity from central bankers everywhere, right, Gabriel? But are we feeling it, ordinary people?
I think many ordinary people are certainly not feeling it. And, I mean, that would be my big risk going forward, is somehow the downtrodden of the world bite back, be it through big picture populism or be it through actual, finally, you know, the gig economy might work in favour of workers, which sounds a bit of a long way off, but at some point, you know, you might get an Uber-type surge in the world economy of pricing, just shortages of labour. You're just starting to see that in some places like Minneapolis in the States and parts of Germany. But at some point, you may get that.
Stephanie, quickly.
I think also the demographic split of wealth inequality is really interesting to watch. So this economy might be working for people who are in the baby boomer generation, but it's certainly not working for millennials, and that we know. And then there's a sort of squeezed middle class. It's not just the downtrodden. It's also as the middle class starts to itself feel disadvantaged.
Stephanie Hare and Gabriel Stern, thank you both very much. The thoughts there of a couple of market analysts on the BBC Business Daily here from the BBC World Service. So what about one of the great sages of modern economics? What does he think? This is the Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz. He's long warned about the imbalances of the global economy, especially those affecting the growing gulf between rich and poor, some of the threats of globalisation that he sees. That's been the theme of the recent update of his best-selling 2002 book, Globalisation and Its Discontents. In December, he spoke to Manuela about its enduring relevance and how the new populism seen in countries on both sides of the Atlantic represents a response, but certainly not an answer, he thinks, to globalization's weaknesses.
What's gone wrong is that the agenda was set by the big corporations. What I try to explain in the book is that doubling down, pursuing the same recipes that we have pursued for the last third of a century is not going to work. Trump, this new protectionism, is not going to work. And so the question is there something that can? And I argued that there is something that can work. It's not globalization itself. It's the way we've managed it. We need a new social contract. We have to have shared prosperity. And I try to explain how we can achieve that shared prosperity. If we do that, then I think there will be the kind of support for globalization and openness that you see in, say, the Nordic countries. But if we don't, I think things could actually get worse. I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody worse than Trump. But if you start concentrating on it, you start thinking about what of the 1930s, I think you can have a picture of how things could actually get worse.
Are you worried?
Yes, I am. Because I don't see, particularly in the United States, where we have this political gridlock and a Republican Party that's going in exactly the wrong direction and actually passing a tax bill now that will lower taxes on the billionaires and on the corporations and raise taxes on ordinary Americans. This is almost inconceivable that they would do it, and it shows the brazenness both of the party and the extent to which the Republican Party has become dependent on their donors and on the belief that if you have enough money, you can effectively buy votes. So we've become a kind of plutocracy of the worst kind. So that is what gives me a great deal of worry. There's an element of hope in writing the book. Obviously, I wouldn't have written the book if I thought this was inevitable. The hope is that just like in the past when we reached this kind of precipice at the end of the 19th century with the Gilded Age and the 1920s and the Roaring 1920s, we stepped back from the precipice. We had major reforms like the Progressive Era. The New Deal introduced major social programs like Social Security that once again Americans will realize what is happening. Not all of them, but enough of them that we will be able to change course.
You speak about new protectionism. Where do you think Brexit falls? I mean, is that new protectionism, or is it, as some people in Theresa May government like to portray it, as Britain opening up to the world and, in fact, a move towards more globalization?
No, I think it's basically withdrawal. I mean, basically, your trading partner is Europe. It's where you're located. And one should be clear about it. The vote for Brexit was not motivated by most people saying we want a more open UK. It was motivated by a lot of people saying what you promised with globalization, what you promised with the EU, wasn't delivered. You promised our standard of living would go up, that there would be jobs, and you've left us behind. You haven't paid attention to our concerns. So it was a very strong message, just like Trump was a very strong message, about the neglect that the elites had shown towards large swaths of society.
I mean, there will be people who say, well, globalization has had its day. People could have made the case, corporations could have made the case, governments could have made the case. They failed. That's why we are where we are now.
Well, you're precisely right. We have failed. The question is it globalization itself, or is it the way we manage it? And we can't really go back in time. We have actually become very interdependent. So the challenge going forward is, how do we live in this interdependent world? And I'm of the belief that we can manage globalization. You know, 150 years ago, people asked the question, can we make the market economy, capitalism, work for most citizens? Can we temper the extremes that we saw, you know, you read about in Dickens' novels? And the answer is, yes, we did temper the market economy. We did make it work. There were major reforms over a period of 150 years. So I think we can do the same thing with globalization. But of course, it won't happen if we're not aware of the problems and we're not aware of why that globalization has been so bad for so many people.
Professor Joe Stiglitz and his new book, Globalization and Its Discontents. There's trouble brewing at one of India's oldest street markets. Stallholders in Kolkata are being undercut by the emergence of new illegal street hawkers, and now they want the government to do something about it. Rahul Tandon has this report.
I am inside one of India's most famous indoor markets. New Market first opened its door to shoppers on the 1st of January, 1874. And over the years, Kolkatans have spent many hours here, wandering from one store to another. Because you can find anything you want in Newmarket, from the finest Kashmir rugs to the latest Tibetan jewellery, the best quality mutton in this city, or the freshest pomegranates from Kabul. But as I wander through the market, it's not as busy as it was a few years ago. Then you had to push or sometimes fight your way through the crowds. Now, you can stroll easily through its narrow lanes. The reason is that people have stopped coming here and instead are buying from the hundreds of hawkers who set up camp outside. Let's go and have a chat with them. I've now come to a stall that's been set up outside Newmarket. In fact, if you look down the pavement that leads into the famous indoor market, it seems to have disappeared and has been replaced by a series of shops run by hawkers. Unlike those inside, these are busy as they're full of customers, locals and tourists, all looking for a bargain and haggling hard with the shopkeepers. Abdul runs this one, which sells bags and suitcases. He tells me that he's from Bangladesh and that business is good. We give people what they want at a price they want, he says. And he's right. His bags are 20% cheaper than the ones you'll find inside. When I ask him if he has a license to operate, he goes quiet for a few minutes and then points at a policeman and says, they're always asking for bribes, taking all our money. We're poor people. Why are you asking such questions? We're just trying to make a living. Where do you want us to go? Before I can respond, he's disappeared to serve another customer. The old shopkeepers of Newmarket know where they want Abdul to go. They want him and the other hawkers removed from these streets. Rajiv Singh's family have had their shop here for many generations. He says, how can we survive? The hawkers pay no rent or taxes, so they can afford to sell their products at prices we cannot. The government should remove them. Look at the entrance to our market, he adds. You cannot even get in anymore, as the hawkers have blocked it off. Rajiv, like many other shopkeepers here, is considering closing his business down, as over the last few years his sales have dropped by more than 30%. He tells me if I sell a product for $8, they'll sell it for $6, as they have no overheads. I cannot compete. But what do customers make of the hawkers? Amrita is here with her 20-year-old daughter, Sonam. She says, yes, I do buy from the hawkers. They're cheaper. I know they're illegal. But with prices rising, I have to watch my penny, so I prefer to use them. Sonam disagrees with her mum. We should support the legitimate shops. Look at the mess the hawkers have made of this street. There's no space left to walk. It's horrible. The state government promises every year to crack down on the hawkers, but nothing happens. Abdul is confident that he'll be hawking here for many more years. Whether Rajiv and his legal shop remain is a much more difficult question to answer.
That was Rahul Tandon reporting from Kolkata in eastern India. If you've missed any of our programmes over the last 30 days, or if you want to share them with your friends, remember you can download them from your favourite podcasting website. It is well worth a go and very popular with many of you, I happen to know. And if you want to discuss anything you've heard on Business Daily, you can become a fan of the BBC Business Facebook page, where all of the best BBC business material is also available to see. Check that out. Perhaps that could be a resolution for 2018. Speak to you tomorrow.